ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Jason DeRosso. Welcome to The Screen Show on ABC Radio National. My guests this week are Academy Award-winning director Chloe Zhao and novelist Maggie O'Farrell, who've teamed up to adapt Maggie's best-selling novel Hamnet for the big screen. It releases this week. It's the story of Shakespeare and how he fell in love with his wife, Anne Hathaway, although here she's named Agnes, which modern Shakespearean scholars tend to agree was probably her birth name, and how the tragedy of losing a child, their son Hamnet, almost tears them apart and inspires the play Hamlet. It stars Paul Mescal and Jesse Buckley and divides its time between the two characters, although, as you'd perhaps expect, we spend a lot of time with Agnes, getting to know her as a courageous, forthright woman who comes from a difficult background and is not fully accepted by Shakespeare's family. It doesn't help that there are rumours circulating that she's descended from forest witches. And this aura of magic around her is something that the film leans into, in the spiritual powers she seems to possess, and visually too, in her love of falconry. And at one point, she's depicted in a red dress, writhing in the damp green as she gives birth like a mystical earth mother. Buckley is a great choice for this role. She brings a thorniness, a calloused quality to the performance, also a sweet, tender, maternal depth. And yes, there is something of the mystical about her as well. This is Zhao's first period picture after her trilogy of documentary-influenced films made in contemporary rural America, Songs My Brothers Taught Me, The Rider and Nomadland, and her 2021 Marvel film Eternals. And there's a modern sensibility to the story, which when you boil it down is about a marriage that comes under enormous strain from within and without. It's a film like the book which embraces a biographical approach to understanding art as something that's the product of the life experiences of the artist. Only here, there are two people in the spotlight. Chloe Zhao is next.
Show me your hand.
What do you see?
I see you grown. Very strong. And I see you in London working with your father.
In the theatre.
At the playhouse.
What will I be doing?
What do you wish to do, Hamlet?
I should be one of the players with a sword.
Sword?
Yes. And I shall clash it against the sword of the other player.
Show me.
There'll be a terrible fight, and everybody watching will be frightened out of their wits.
And who will win?
I shall, of course.
Of course you shall.
Chloe Zhao, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thanks for having me. Hello.
When did you first read Maggie O'Farrell's novel, and did you think it was particularly cinematic on the page?
I thought it was exceptionally cinematic, the way she writes. I read it maybe 2 years ago, 2-3 years ago. I did not read it when it first came out. I only read it when they told me about the project.
And, you know, it's a film about obviously how a man and a woman react to a great tragedy in their lives, and they react in different ways. Mm-hmm. Equally, it's also about artistic work and how artists sometimes bury themselves in their work in order to perhaps work through their pain. Do you find that your work is a way for you to deal with your own personal traumas sometimes?
I have a feeling you know the answer to that question. Yes, absolutely. It's how I survived this far.
And what is it about working, do you think? Because obviously the other side to this story is that the work does also create a kind of insularity there. And this is also a story about, you know, a husband and wife who find it difficult to connect. You know, the grief draws them apart. The work draws them apart.
I think the work is the symptom, not the, you know, it's a coping mechanism, not the root cause. You know, so I believe that you know, historically we have shamed the wailing women. And let's not shame the repressed men now. We all arrived here under the same conditioning. So I think as a woman, I have loved, was raised by, and still love men that are very similar to William Shakespeare's character in the film, who cannot express their emotions, and many of them don't even know how they feel anymore because that emotionality was shamed and repressed. It was never safe when they were young. And so to see what Agnes brings to Will's life and the way she helps him to feel and to point out there's an internal landscape, you know, even though he's still, the generational trauma is very clear there, even though he still doesn't have the healthy tools to express it, but what she was able to inspire him to do is to do it through his art. And that's a lifeline for him, right? And that then created mirrors for others who may not be able to express that, to come together. So the hopeful thing is that our lack and our trauma in some ways are also has the transformative power to turn into gold, right? Shadows can be alchemized into golden shadows.
Your early work, your first three films in particular, often in those films you embrace documentary techniques. Sometimes there are non-professional actors, improvisation and so forth. And I'm wondering if those techniques are still important to you and were important in your creative practice on this film, which is a very different film in one sense because it's a period drama, it's a costume drama.
I think so. And I think that is probably it's probably because something in me needed this way of working even earlier on. And it's because I think it's because the way my brain, I'm neurodivergent, and the way my brain is constructed, that I do have a super detector for dissonance to a point that I can't handle small talk because I can feel the sadness behind the smile, right? So it helps me directing, but it also need me to, it also makes me have to make sure my actors are present all the time. There's no preconceived how this thing should go and how this character should feel, how should she grieve when her son dies. It's got to be present, moment to moment. And whatever came through Jesse, for example, in a scene like that, none of us, even Jesse, didn't know where she was going to go. And so I would say what I learned to create the safe container for the non-actors to feel comfortable, I definitely brought that through and 10 times more in creating containers for my actors on a fiction film to be as present as possible.
I'm interested in how you worked with Jesse Buckley. Obviously, actors, sometimes it's quite difficult to get a lot of time with them before shooting begins, a time with them for rehearsals, let alone even extended periods in pre-production. But I understand with Jesse, you were able to develop a creative relationship in order to try and talk through or develop her character before shooting began. Can you tell me a little bit about that process and what it was like and how long it lasted?
I wouldn't say it was a long process. Like, she had another film right before. We actually only had her 2 weeks before we started shooting. Before I even wrote the script, I wrote it for her. And she and I had done creative dream work. You know, we have spent sister times together dealing with our own personal things as friends. We chatted about the character, but very little. We went to play with Falcon. with birds, we did some falconry together, but very, very minimal because I'm looking for presence, right? So I'm not scared of not having time with actors. I trust that, you know, actors like Jesse and Paul, they do their own work. They do their own exploration. And whoever they were playing right before this, or wherever they are in their personal lives, those are all my clues. I believe in synchronicities. Those are all my clues in what they're going to bring on day one. And then we go from there. Let's see. So week one is nerve-wracking for me because week one, I don't know who these characters are. They don't know who they are. We're going to find it on the first day of shooting.
And when you say dream work, I think that was the expression you used. Is that, are you talking about a kind of therapeutic exact term or you're talking more metaphorically?
Yeah, so we're students of Carl Jung. And so, he is very, very much, believe that dreams are the language of the psyche.
Oh, yes, of course, the Jungian, right, yes.
Jungian, yeah, I am very much a Jungian and person. And my teacher, who Jesse introduced me to, our dream work teacher, Kim Gillingham, is a student of Marion Woodman, who is a student of Carl Jung. So we come from that lineage. And another word is active imagination, except in dream work, we specifically work with dreams. And I believe that what's exciting for me, the prep work, is to open the portal in the unconscious realm between Paul and Jesse and Will and Agnes, because the collective unconscious exists past, present, future. It's not linear, right? So and I also believe characters choose actors as much as actors choose characters, and stories choose us as much as we choose them. Isn't something we're controlling. So if it's chosen, then there must be a reason. And dreams, right? I just don't believe whoever created or however this world exists, that half of the time we're sleeping and dreaming and it's just there
For the cells to regenerate or something. No, you believe there's something else going on. Yeah,
exactly. And if you look at indigenous societies, cultures from all of our past, everyone talked about dreams, right? And it's a language that we lost. So I mean, it was really exciting to open that portal. And Jesse recorded her dreams almost every day. And she will then do the dream work, gave me the material, and I would take that material, throw everything away on the day, and just film that, and that's how it worked.
I've heard you write. I've read that you've written about this film. You've often described it within the context of the word fear, and confronting fears. I suppose. Do you believe we live in particularly fearful times?
I think when we were first born, you know, even when we were young, like kids, we weren't that afraid of death, right? Like all fears can trace back to that one. So I just focus on that one. But we weren't that afraid. And that is because we didn't believe in the illusion of separation. And the more we buy into the illusion of separation, the more we can be controlled and the more we can be brainwashed and the more we could be convinced to buy things, et cetera, et cetera. So I understand why that illusion is drilled into our brain as soon as we could learn anything. But the life's greatest purpose, if you're a Jungian, you know, it's individuation. It's about stripping away those layers and get back to the essence of who you are, which is your soul. It's like when you were born, that you didn't have these illusions. I do think we unfortunately live at a time like that. But I also believe in nature balance things out. You can really feel a different consciousness coming through in the world, through art, through different domain is coming through, because the imbalance is so painful right now, unbearable. that we know we have to balance it out.
Just finally, you often edit your films, or at least in this case, I believe you assembled the film in the editing room before having an editor come in to finish off.
Yeah.
Why do you like to do that? A lot of directors like the separation, you know, between the shooting and the process of editing. Why do you like to edit?
Because the way I work and because how present everything is, I'm very much a different person a year and a half later. I use my art work, my storytelling, to try to explore who I am and trying to go through on that journey of individuation. And so a year and a half of that type of work, I'm not the same person. So I need to go back in and try to see who is this director, this writer trying to say, and what came through in this year and a half that needs to be integrated that the person in the past wouldn't have imagined.
I've really enjoyed speaking to you. Thank you. You've been so articulate about your process and so many other things. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Chloe Zhao, the director and co-screenwriter of Hamnet. Now to the author of the original book, who also had a hand in writing the screenplay, Maggie O'Farrell. I began the interview by asking how this collaboration came about.
We met on Zoom, and I had heard that Chloe wanted to make a film, was interested in making a film of Hamnet. And I came on the call absolutely prepared that I was going to say that I didn't want to write the script and that I was going to hand it over, and I'd be interested in, but not involved. But Chloe's a very persuasive person, and by the end of the call, by the time I shut my laptop, I had agreed to co-write the script, and I'd agreed to produce a first pass within about a couple of months. And so I did walk out of my room, and I thought, what the hell happened? You know, I'd done a massive U-turn. But she is a very persuasive person, and I was massively excited because I knew that she wasn't going to make a kind of prissy costume drama, which is exactly what I wanted it to be, or that's exactly what I didn't want it to be. And I knew also that she didn't come necessarily from a background or a culture that was steeped in Shakespeare. She's, you know, I think she would be the first person to describe herself not as a Shakespearean. And so I loved the idea that she was coming at it from an interesting and new angle, and that she wanted to focus the story on Agnes.
But how did she convince you?
I think she said something like, I want to make the book, and I'm going to need you to write it with me. So I think it was just, I don't know. Maybe she put a spell on me. Who knows? I can't really describe why I completely changed my mind, but I did. And I'm really glad that I did. Like, whatever instinct it was that possessed me was the right one.
Yeah. Are you a Jungian as well? Do you have that sort of framework informing the way you write and the things that you write about, or is that not the case? And that was part of the exchange between you?
I think Chloe and I have very different in some ways, but quite similar in another. I think I really liked her vision for the film, and it was very interesting the way she was talking, you know, because the book, I mean, the novel doesn't play a huge amount with chronology, but it's a little bit, it does skip back and forth in time. And so the first task, as she described it, was to sort of, in a sense, disassemble the non-chronology and then reassemble it. So, because obviously it's fine to jump about in chronology in a novel, but in a screen it's a bit of a tax on the reader. It's quite jarring if you jump about in time on screen. So in a sense, that was the first sort of task that we had to do. But I think I found the whole process fascinating because obviously, you know, I've been writing novels for a long time, so I think I know how to assemble a narrative for the book, but in terms of, you know, distilling a novel into a screenplay, it's just the first task is to strip and narrow it right down to its very kind of pith so that it's 90-page screenplay or whatever. And then it was really fascinating when you take that kind of very distilled version to watch Chloe expand it out again into a film. So all the details that you strip back from the novel, they all need to translate into details in film and in a completely different language.
Did you find yourself becoming possessive over the script at all? In terms of when it became time to shoot it, were you thinking, oh my goodness, I want to be on set. I want to, you know, Did you have to sort of suppress that?
I was on set for quite a lot of it, but I didn't feel, I think possessiveness isn't part of it. I think if you go into a process like this feeling possessive or thinking that it's of yours, then you are going to have a bad experience. But you have to, you know, the book is mine and it always will be, but the film is Chloe's and that's as it should be. You know, it would be wrong for me to hang on to it or to, you know, insert myself between Chloe and her actors and the story, because the film shouldn't be a replica of the novel. You know, it's going to sit alongside it in a sense. It's going to be a different version of it, somebody else's vision. And I was very happy for Chloe to do that. I felt that I really trusted her. I trusted her and her vision and her methods completely. I think if there were any kind of disagreements we had, it was always about authenticity, because I'm a massive swot. And I would say things like, I'm afraid people didn't wear that or say that in the surgery, which is probably really annoying.
Yeah, because she has made a film that is definitely, you know, I think people who are looking for a period drama, a costume drama, will be satisfied, but it has a contemporary kind of veneer to it, I think. There's stylistically, there's something slightly contemporary there. There's a compromise that's been made, which often happens, I think, in film, probably is less comfortable for historical fiction writers, in a sense.
Sticklers, like me. Yeah, exactly. No, I think you have to, I think as the novelist or as co-screenwriter, you have to let go of it. And that's fine. I'm very happy to that. Because the book is the way I wanted to tell the story initially, and that'll be there, and that'll always be there for me. So it's fine. I'm very happy for her to hand it over and for her to do her magic.
I was really surprised to read that because I'm not a Shakespeare scholar like yourself, but I was surprised that I think you've said that there's very little scholarship on the effect of the death of Shakespeare's son on him, which strikes me as very strange given that, you know, Hamnet and Hamlet, as the film points out in an early title card, were interchangeable names at this point in history. So, you know, the link, even in the title of the play, is very strong. And yet there's not much known about or even researched about how it may have affected him.
Yeah, so the title card is from an essay by the scholar Stephen Greenblatt, who wrote an essay about Hamnet and Hamlet. And at the time I was researching the book, that was the only thing. It's a fantastic essay. I think it was in the New York Times several years ago. But yes, I think the whole purpose or the engine behind me writing the novel was that I always felt that not enough people knew about Hamnet Shakespeare. Not enough people knew that Shakespeare had a son who died when he was age 11 and that he'd been called Hamnet, and that William went on to write a play with the same name, because the names were interchangeable at the time because spelling was a lot less stable in those days. And it's always really baffled me, the fact that nobody has asked this question, apart from Stephen Greenblatt, you know, that he's not better known, you know. And so I wanted to kind of say to the world, you know, this child was really important. He was loved, he was grieved, he was taken very, very young. And without him, we wouldn't have the play Hamlet, and we probably wouldn't have Twelfth Night.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also curious about how much do you think, I mean, really the film ends up being about both things. It's about how a woman and a man process grief very differently, but it's also about the artistic process being a kind of therapeutic process. That's difficult if you're not inside that process for the partner of someone who's buried in it. But it can be therapeutic for the person involved in that process. And I'm wondering if you could tell me at its core, I mean, what do you think the film is about? And does it differ much from the book in the end? Did it become thematically different?
I think it's very close to the book. I think it uses the book as a kind of basis, but it sort of takes things. I think one of the things it brings out more clearly is the love story, really. And when I say love story, I mean, you know, most love stories end with the I do. They end with the going up the aisle and then, you know, fade to black, credits roll. But this is a love story which goes beyond that. I mean, the marriage in their story, in William and Anissa's story, happens about a third of the way in. And then you get down to the real gritty stuff of life, you know, how after the I do you cope with the huge and often very traumatic things that life can throw at you? What happens to your love? How does it change? How does a marriage survive? How does a love survive these terrible tests upon it? And, you know, it's always been a question in my mind whenever I've been thinking about Hamnet and the play Hamlet, which was, you know, how did his mother feel? How did she feel when she knew that her husband had taken the name and written a play? Maybe she was happy. But I'm not sure I would be thrilled if it had been my child. I don't know. We don't know how she felt. But that question was something, you know, I often think that stories and fiction or films come from a question, come from something you don't quite know the answer to. And you write your novel or your screenplay or make your film trying to answer it to yourself. And so that was my question. How did Agnes feel about it? And what happened when she saw it?
Did you read Germaine Greer's book on Shakespeare's work? And how did you, because very little is known about her and just like about Shakespeare, but less about her. Where did you end up coming down on what you thought of her and her contribution? Because, of course, Germaine had this theory that she contributed quite a bit to Shakespeare's work.
I think Germaine's book, I should say Germaine Greer, as if I know her, Germaine Greer's book, Shakespeare's Wife, is an absolutely brilliant piece of scholarship. It's fascinating. It's a real masterpiece of research and scholarship. And that was a really key book when I was writing the novel, because what Greer does is, you know, pull her out from the shadows. And she does an amazing, you know, she's obviously gone through all the records in Stratford and in Shottery to sort of trace this woman's path, because Shakespeare himself was actually, so much, he's got, on one hand, he's got this enormous body of work, but there's actually not that much known about him. But there's even less known about his wife, Agnes. And, one of the big questions, one of the big shocks for me was finding out that a year before they got married, that Richard Hathaway, Agnes's father, died. And in it, he refers to her as my daughter, Agnes, or Agnes. Which makes you think, well, why have we been calling her Anne for 500 years? You know, and everybody refers to her as Anne Hathaway as if her name for most of her life wasn't Shakespeare. You know, and I was just fascinated by the idea of this, you know, icon that we called Anne Hathaway, who's very mysterious and often really vilified, which is something really brilliant that Greer takes people to task for, previous scholars and biographers, for criticising her and vilifying her and saying William didn't love her and that they were forced to get married, he hated her, he moved to London to get away from her, all that rubbish, which there's no evidence for at all. And she does, Greer does an amazing job at saying, actually, we need to try and forget all those preconceptions and that strange misogynistic narrative and open ourselves up to the possibility that, yes, they were in love.
Well, you've added to her work, certainly with this with your novel and now this film and the screenplay that you've co-written. Maggie, it's been great. Thank you.
A pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Maggie O'Farrell, the big screen adaptation of her best-selling novel, Hamnet, is an emotionally intense drama, sometimes pulls the odd hamstring when it overexerts itself, reaching for that dramatic intensity. It also sometimes trips up on overstatement, but you can't call it uncommitted. Readers found her book a fascinating hypothesis on the origins of one of the greatest plays of all time, and I think this film will connect with the same audience. Hamnet is in cinemas now.
The women in my family see things.
What do you see?
I see a landscape. Oceans.
You're having twins, my girl.
Undiscovered countries. What do you wish to do, Hamlet?
I shall be one of father's players.
Will you be brave?
Yes.
Will you be brave?
Please! When shall we three meet again?
Our children's hearts beat. They smile, play. Never forget for a moment.
Mama.
They may be gone.
Mama.
My boy. He lives not.
This is The Screen Show. I'm Jason DeRosso. ABC Radio National is the station. And next, to a highlight from last year, one of my favourite films of 2025, a crowd-pleasing, well-made biopic about Bob Dylan called A Complete Unknown, starring Timothy Chalamet. It was a film that created a huge amount of buzz when it released back in January. It spans the period of Dylan's life from when he comes under the mentorship of folk hero Pete Seeger, played by Edward Norton, perfect in his patrician well-meaningness, to when he breaks with the acoustic folk scene and goes electric, a turning of the page that for some folk purists was a complete betrayal, and they got very upset about it. Writer-director James Mangold is a classical American storyteller, and this is a great showcase of his talents, working off a script co-written with Jay Cox, a frequent Scorsese and Catherine Bigelow collaborator. He builds a story about a surrogate father-son relationship that outlives its usefulness and a love triangle involving two women, Joan Baez, played by Monica Barbaro, Dylan's rival and muse, and a semi-fictional girlfriend, Sylvie Russo, played by Elle Fanning, Dylan's first real supporter. Dylan, meanwhile, remains unknowable, like the title suggests, a complete unknown. Where does he come from? Why does he do what he does? There's no political agenda, at least not in the orthodox sense, pursued by his folk idols. But there is an artistic instinct and a self-belief and a courage to challenge ideas of authenticity. The film is about Dylan the chameleon, a man who reinvents himself again and again. A man who doesn't believe in looking back, to paraphrase the title of D.A. Pennybaker's documentary. And a man who is sometimes oblivious to the people he leaves behind. The close friends in the film, Joan and Sylvie and Pete Seeger, are important because they don't give in without a fight. Joan flips him the bird on stage at one point when they're playing to a very large crowd. And it's the tension between Bob and Pete towards the end of the film that's the most fascinating, because Pete is such a chill kind of guy and Dylan gets under his skin. As Dylan, Chalamet is intense, he's enigmatic, he is a cool ghost with bad posture and cigarette-stained fingers, playing guitar without apparent effort, picking up his friend's clothes off the floor and wearing them better than anyone else. James Mangold's film is not as cool as Chalamet is in it. Cool is that D.A. Pennybaker documentary or Todd Haynes' film I'm Not There, where Dylan is deconstructed by different actors who play him, including Cate Blanchett. A Complete Unknown is trad by comparison, a biopic by the same guy who made Walk the Line after all, a kind of classic of the genre. But it's also really good. It captures something true about the energy and the volatility of its subject and the times. And it delivers us Dylan's music, re-recorded for the soundtrack with Chalamet's voice. He's pretty good, full of poetic dissonance and exquisite imperfection. Here it sounds almost as urgent as it must have back when it was responding to a world that seemed on fire in the 60s. And maybe that's why the film also felt so resonant for me when I saw it at the beginning of 2025. I spoke to director James Mangold back then about his vision, and you can hear that conversation by finding our episode from the 23rd of January. But I also spoke to actor Ed Norton, who, as I said, plays Pete Seeger in the film, my favourite character, and that's who you're going to hear from in a moment. Norton is an actor, filmmaker, and political activist. And for a few years now, I've watched him start to grow into a middle period of wiry, tall, wasp physicality, almost like a Gen X Jimmy Stewart. He is light years from his performances in Fight Club or American History X in this movie. We first meet him sitting by the sickbed of his friend Woody Guthrie. His version of Pete Seeger is a walking, talking embodiment of kindness, generosity, commitment. And eventually, for Dylan at least, he was also exhausting, a smothering father figure. A clip coming up, and then Edward Norton.
I want to tell you a little story. A few months back, my friend Woody Guthrie and I, we met a young man. He dropped in on us out of nowhere, and he played us a song. In that moment, we got a feeling we were getting a glimpse of the future.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Oh, where have you been, my darling young one? I stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests.
It's great to be talking to you about this movie, and in particular about this role, because it's a role in the film that really kind of haunted me, to be honest. It's strange. It's a remarkable performance. You play Pete Seeger with this gentleness, but I'd describe it as this muscular gentleness. And I wanted to ask you about that playing a character who is so kind of soft on the surface but is very strong as a person. What's that like as an actor? Is that a difficult pitch to hit?
I think muscular gentleness is a nice phrase for Pete Seeger. I might steal that from you. Well, I don't know if I'd say difficult per se, but I agree with the assessment, and I had the same... The reaction it created in you is very similar to the one I got, that I get from Pete as well. To be honest, I think you're articulating what a lot of people felt about him. I think he was admired for his almost, oak tree-like integrity and relentless commitment to the cause of humanity. He really eschewed an enormous amount of what we would associate with artistic stardom. He never really pursued money ever. He never lived a fancy life. He never looked at commercial success as the benchmark of his own achievement. He really believed and I think lived the idea that the music was an instrument of change and of advocacy. I've never met Dylan, but I think that if I recall, and you might want to ask Jim Mangold about this if you talk to him, but I believe Jim told me that one of the things Dylan said to him about Pete Seeger was that there really was nothing bad you could say about him other than that sometimes he was so relentless that you had to say, Pete, I you got to give me a break. Joan Baez told me that I asked her if when she hadn't seen him for a long time, she would hug him or he would hug her, because sometimes when you look for little moments like there's a scene in the movie where Dylan and Pete haven't seen each other in a long time. And you say to yourself, well, I don't know, would these guys walk up and give each other a big hug? That's a pretty important, important thing.
Is he a hugger?
And she said to me, oh Lord, no, she said we were all hippies and touchy feely. And she said, Pete used that banjo like a shield, you knew he loved you, but he was not expressive in that way. He was very reticent. But she told me one time she hadn't seen him in a long time and that she ran up to him and said, hi, Pete, and that he said, something about how he'd just been down to Guatemala and they really had to do something to support the people there. And she said she kind of was like going, hi, Pete, great to see you. You know what I mean?
No small talk.
Kind of always in the fight. One of the things I'm wandering a little bit, but I think you'll get where I'm going. But I remember Spike Lee's movie Do the Right Thing was a real revelation to me when I saw it. I don't know if you had that. Like when I was 18 or 19 when that movie came out, that movie's like a hand grenade, in American culture. And it was so explosive even to the form of movie making to a lot of us. But I think one of the great achievements of that film is at the end, it sort of just puts up that photograph of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X together. And then it has a quote from Martin Luther King and a quote from Malcolm X, and they're almost diametrically opposed philosophically. And it just leaves it in your lap. Like that movie just refuses to answer the question of this dichotomy, right? It just says, these are two positions around how to deal with what we're, and it leaves it right in your lap, just squarely, and asking questions and not answering questions. And to this day, I profoundly admire that film and him for forcing you to answer the question yourself. The thing I'm not even sure I knew it doing it, but when I looked at this, I felt like Jim, he does this kind of remarkable thing, which is all these people collide with each other in this film in this kind of very, this emergent moment in culture, and they come to a fissure, they're all bound up and then there's a fissure, but he doesn't he doesn't come to a judgment. The film never comes to any kind of a judgment. You know, it's like Dylan's integrity as a music artist is its own thing, and Pete Seeger's integrity as a humanist, and Joan Byans' integrity as a musician. And he kind of just lets it all be. I love how much Jim just lets it all be. I love things that don't come to a judgment. It acknowledges that there are different kinds of integrity. They might coexist for a while, and then they might not coexist and part ways, and that's okay too. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I actually have spoken to James Mangold already, but so I won't get to ask him that other question. But I did also point out to him that it seemed to me like a kind of archetypal father-son story. And it is a story from Dylan's point of view of a son needing to break away. And that doesn't kind of delegitimize what the father stands for, but it does suggest that they can't be one in the same anymore. They've got to break away. The son has to find his independence, which is kind of what this story is. I mean, did you see him as a father figure as such, a kind of surrogate father figure?
I'm not saying this in a glib way. I have all kinds of thoughts about it. And sometimes you got to, you know, lock in on your own definition. But I'm very, maybe it's because it's a film about Dylan. I profoundly admire Bob Dylan, even as a young man. He knew he shouldn't dissect his own, the work, because it all it did was take away the power of it, you know?
And that's true. That's true.
I have thoughts, but I'm always very reluctant to impose an interpretation, because then all it does is reduce anybody. Someone might look at Pete Seeger and Bob Dylan and think they were like brothers, you know, brothers in arms, or that they were like Trotsky and Stalin, you know, or that they were like, there's all kinds of ways you can interpret it. But in some sense, I think the best thing is for people to let it refract through themselves. You know what I mean? I don't think it has to be father and son. I don't think it has to be brothers. I don't think it can be all of that. It can be whatever you've been through in your own life. And it doesn't even have to be just about musicians. You know what I mean? Because I think a bunch of teachers who teach in the same school and a new one shows up and they have a different style can go through these kinds of social dynamics. Doctors can go through it. People in, you know what I mean? We all operate in spheres where we have peers and we have someone who inspired us. We have pilgrimages that we make to places that we're on some path and we want to walk in the footsteps of someone else who walked in that path. And then we get in there and we have colleagues and we have competitors. And I think people in all walks of life can relate to some of these dynamics. You know what I mean? You can relate to someone in your peer group having a kind of talent that is intimidating and inspiring at the same time. You know, I think what I like about Jim's approach to it was that he was more interested in looking at the dynamics of collisions between people than he was, you know, kind of knocking down a biopic of a life from start to finish, you know, which is, to be honest, so many traps within it. And I think if we're all going to still actually get out of the house and go to the cinema and sit in front of a big screen, you know, these days it's like we're looking for immersion. We're looking for an immersive experience. And I thought Jim was really onto something when he was saying, like, let's not come to conclusions. Let's try to create a portal through which people can feel in a visceral sense the innocence and the youth and the social, you know. I mean, it's hard for us today to remember. I mean, we have the things, we have Gaza and we have Ukraine and we have all these things, but then the Cuban Missile Crisis, and there's a great thing in that film, that sequence where they think that the Cuban Missile Crisis might be about to blow up. I mean, I got a history degree. I studied all that stuff. But you realize that you read about it, that's an academic experience. And I was even struck watching the film going, man, it really struck me how scared people were in that moment, you know, how much fear there actually was in that moment. And
I think he does that. You're right. The film does, I recall thinking this as well, watching it, the film does a really good job at kind of evoking the tension in the air, I think.
and just the general broader sense of anxiety, I think, from which, well, against which some of this music was actually actively pitching itself, and from which some of the music was just emerging. Well, I mean, where does Seeger, where does that tradition lie today? Or is it kind of been swept away? Does it not exist? Is it too kind of innocent in a sense? Because obviously Dylan's still here, and what Dylan started is kind of still, I mean, it still feels contemporary. Some things that Seeger sings and some of those songs of Woody Guthrie and so forth seem like from another era in a sense. I don't know if you agree.
I certainly think that the idea of musicians being political was a lot more punk rock in the 30s socialist union labor era. It was a fairly radical thing to do. Even being labeled a radical kind of comes from that time. I'm not even sure I'd say it's, I don't know, we live in a, like art is in danger of being turned into content and being industrialized today. And I think the industrialization of music is making it a lot harder for music to be political, fundamentally political. But also maybe we just don't have people stepping up to that ambition anymore. I don't see a lot of aspiration in music today to be mission driven in the way that Pete Seeger was. You're right, the reason a lot of Dylan's stuff became more eternal is because he left behind the literalism of, you know, he wrote some powerful, beautiful political songs, but maybe the ones that are still with us today are the ones that hover up in the mystical and in the poetic and in the emotional more than contextual, you know?
Yeah, I'd agree.
I definitely feel, you know, in our time, I feel like OK Computer and records like that certainly like were zeitgeisty, right? I mean, if not political, certainly like in the same period we were making Fight Club and stuff. I think, you know, that end of millennia kind of sense of anxiety, we certainly have like people tapping, still trying to tap like generational anxiety and generational, you know, emotional state. I agree with you. It's hard to find, you know, people aren't really writing union songs anymore. You know what I mean? I was thinking, who are the actual sort of, because Dylan really didn't take the torch from Pete Seeger. Pete Seeger was fundamentally, he was political. And Dylan was relentlessly not political. And I think that's, in some sense, what you see in the film is musical integrity and political integrity aren't the same thing necessarily. But you know, I think like Billy Bragg, like I love Billy Bragg, right? Mm. And I think if you know, he's got those great songs that aren't political, but if you listen, Billy Bragg in a lot of ways to me is the modern UK equivalent of Pete Seeger. He really actually took up the cause of working people and he sang about working people and their struggles. He unapologetically kind of lifted the flag of labor, you know, literally of labor. And he wrote great music, great, hugely influential kind of music in the middle of Thatcherite England.
Sure, especially those early albums were very, I mean, there was all that. Then he kind of went softer by his own admission.
I was a minor, you know, I mean, yeah, he's literally writing lines. I was a minor, I was a, you know, and I think Billy would tell you that he was deeply influenced by Pete Seeger and loved him and felt affirmed by him. I think he told me once that Pete Seeger reached out to him and engaged with him and I actually think Bruce Springsteen is more the descendant of Pete Seeger in a lot of ways. You know, also I think really genuinely wanting to dig into the struggles of working people and sing their songs and then also become overtly political himself. I mean, Bruce is unapologetically political. He gets out in front of cause and of the progressive cause and advocates for working people without apology, you know, and he does go to rallies and he does sing for a side. He, you know, it's funny, like one of Pete Seeger's really, really famous songs from the Union period is Which Side Are You On? And I think Bruce has been a latter generation artist who's been unapologetic and unafraid to pick a side and declare what side he's on and stand with working people. And so it's not like we don't have anyone anymore. It does seem maybe harder for, well, I don't know. See, I'm meditating on this as you're saying it. And I was about to say, has there ever been a time when overtly political songs were also so commercially successful as the period in this film, you know, where folk music was punk rock almost. It was the most punk thing. It was the anti-establishment. It was songs about cause were pop songs, you know. But, you know, I mean, Bruce certainly, you know, Ghost of Tom Joad is a pretty political song.
Yeah. I do think this film does parachute you back into this folk era, the height of folk, and kind of reminds you of what I do think feels like a different era from this vantage point. And I think that's a very, and it does it very immersively, and it's quite a powerful thing. Edward, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Yeah. No, I appreciate the questions.
Ed Norton, who plays Pete Seeger in A Complete Unknown, a film about Bob Dylan, which didn't receive the Oscars love that it probably deserved, but I recommend it to you. You can find it streaming on various platforms. I'm Jason DeRosso. This has been The Screen Show on Radio National. I'll be back next time with 100% fresh content. So do tune in. But it's bye for now. Thanks as always to Sarah Corbett, producer, and Rhiannon Brown, editor of arts on ABC Radio National. I'll leave you with some music from the soundtrack to A Complete Unknown, Timothy Chalamet and Ed Norton here on vocals as Dylan and Seeger.
The wind for the hurricane begins, the hour that the ship comes in, and the seas will split and the ship will hit, and the sands on the shoreline will be shaken. And the tide will sound, and the wind will pound, and the morning will be breaking. A song will lift as the mainsail shifts, and the boat drifts onto the shoreline.
And the sun will respect every face out on the deck,
the hour that the ship comes in. And the sands will roll out a carpet of gold for your weary toes to be a-touching. And the ship's wise men will remind you once again that the whole wide world is watching.
The sleep still in their eyes, and they'll jerk from their beds and think they're dreaming.
But they'll pinch themselves and squeal, and they'll know that it's for real. The hour that the ship comes in, and they'll raise their hands, saying, we'll meet all your demands. But we'll shout from the bow, your days are numbered. And like Pharaoh's tribe, they'll be drowned in the tide. And like Goliath, they'll be caught.